Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 371, Side 2, being recorded on August 5th of 2002. We're speaking with Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey, and the Postwar Fascist International. Kevin, I'm going to ask you to briefly recap our discussion of François Genoux, Jacques Vergès, and Carlos the Jackal, and we're going to tie those people in with some people with more contemporary references.
Sure. Well, in brief, François Genoux was a major banker for the Nazi International after World War II. Genoux was a Swiss citizen whose connections to German intelligence actually trace back, actually like Yockey, to the period of the 1930s, but whose most significant role occurred in the post-war period. Now, as a banker to the far right, Genoux followed the kind of geopolitical strategy that I earlier talked about, the Haushofer strategy of using third world anti-colonial movements for the benefit of Germany and the far right. And so Genoux became a financier, in fact he set up a bank in Geneva, to help finance the National Liberation Front of Algeria during the struggle for Algerian independence in the 1950s. And Genoux's bank was considered the treasury bank for the FLN. Now, during the period of the late 1950s, Genoux made contact with a radical French lawyer named Jacques Vergès, who himself had come out of the Communist Party milieu, but broke with the French Communist Party because he felt it did not support Algerian independence strongly enough. Now, this alliance was maintained all through the 1980s and 1990s, and it became most noticeable in the early 1980s when Genoux hired Vergès to represent legally Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon. And this actually attracted some press attention at the time. But perhaps the most fascinating connection of all is that Genoux, through his work with radical nationalist Arab groups, and particularly with a group, the PFLP, which was a Palestinian radical organization, actually more extreme than Arafat's PLO, Genoux became good friends with Carlos the Jackal, who carried out numerous terrorist attacks in Europe during the 1970s and 1980s. And when Carlos the Jackal was finally arrested by the French a few years ago, Genoux immediately began helping him out as well legally. And in fact, in the books, there are two books in French, two investigative biographies of Genoux, and in both books, you can actually see letters reproduced between Carlos and Genoux, letters that Carlos wrote to Genoux in prison, when he's in prison in Paris. Now, where Vergès pops up again is that it turns out that Carlos's lawyer in Paris is herself a member of Vergès's law firm. And she, in my opinion, is clearly working in the same sort of pattern that was established by Vergès and Genoux, and that still continues today, although Genoux died a few years ago.
And Isabelle Coutant-Père is the French attorney for Zacharias Moussaoui. Zacharias Moussaoui is now immortalized as the alleged 20th hijacker. Go ahead, Kevin.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
A person who dovetails with some of the activities that were going on in the Middle East and who also has a Third Reich heritage is a guy named Johann von Leers. If you could tell us briefly about von Leers and how he fits into this mosaic.
Well, von Leers began in the 1920s as a propagandist who produced tons of anti-Semitic pamphlets and also pamphlets against the Catholic Church. He later began working for Goebbels in the 1930s in the Ministry of Propaganda. But when Leers becomes most noticeable is actually after the war, because von Leers goes from Germany in, I think, 1948, actually to Argentina, to Buenos Aires, where the Germans had the Nazis really had a very strong colony under the protection of Juan Perón in Argentina. And he becomes the editor of a publication called Der Weg, which means the way or the path, which was probably the most important, unabashedly Nazi publication of the post-war era.
By the way, that's spelled D-E-R, and the second word is W-E-G.
Yes. Yep.
Go ahead.
Which is, that publication is probably one of the most important unabashedly Nazi publications of the post-war era, and it circulated, all throughout Europe. In fact, Yockey wrote for it. Yockey The other people I mentioned in the first part of this interview, H.K. Thompson and Fred Weiss, also wrote for Dirac.
Now, when von Leers eventually, he originally, well, I guess initially, was based in Argentina in Latin America, but eventually he moved to the Middle East where he began dovetailing with people like Janu and the Grand Mufti. I wonder if you'd tell us more about his Middle Eastern activities.
What happened is that von Leers was so famous for his anti-Semitic propaganda, both during the war and after the war, that it actually attracted the attention of these extreme right Arabs, and the Egyptians in particular. And so von Leers was invited to go to Cairo to set up a propaganda branch for Nasser. Remember that Nasser and his officers' movement took power in Egypt in a coup in the early 1950s. And so once they got into power, they invited von Leers to come and help run their propaganda apparatus, which in fact von Leers did. And he did so actually quite effectively until his death in 1965. And when von Leers, for example, is one of the people who was helped to translate Mein Kampf into Arabic.
Now, when von Leers, and he actually ran, was it called the Institute for the Study of Zionism?
Yes.
Under Nasser. And the Nasser Free Officers Coup, which also involved Anwar Sadat, drew on a lot of people who had a Third Reich heritage, and again, in the context of some of the anti-British and anti-French colonial activity that took place in the Middle East prior to and during World War II. Now, you have written, Kevin, of Johann von Leers, and he ultimately converted to Islam.
Yes.
And when he did this, he also eventually came in contact with a fellow named Alfred Huber, and persuaded him to come to a similar viewpoint. Tell us about von Leers, his conversion to Islam, and Alfred, later Ahmed Huber.
It's Albert Huber, actually. It's rather amazing that I actually met. I was in Europe a few months ago, and I met with Huber at his home in Bern. And one of the things we talked about was his meeting Leers. Because Huber, boasted to me about how close he was to Leers and how impressed he was by Leers. The Huber story is a long and complicated one, as are many of these stories. But it's actually, when one looks at it, you'll see that they're all in a very small world. For example, Huber was very close to François Janu,
mm-hmm.
and he told me that he and Janu would meet regularly every Thursday. For years at Janu's house in Geneva. Huber is a fellow who was born in Switzerland in 1927. He began actually as a socialist and was a very important figure in the press division of the Socialist Party. And he later in 1960, it's kind of a curious story, Huber said that as a member of the Socialist Party, he met with people from the FLN who were visiting Switzerland to try and acquire weapons to fight against the French.
And again, the FLN was the
Algerian
anti-French underground when Algeria was still a French colonial property.
Precisely. Mm-hmm. And he said that in his conversations with his contacts from the FLN, he said that he was very impressed at the way that they were both very political and very religious in the same way. And he said that it got him very interested in the whole nature of Islam, so much so that he converted to Islam in 1960. And as part of his conversion process, he went to Egypt, to El Anzar University in Cairo, which is sort of the theological center of much of Islamic thinking. And while at the university and while visiting Egypt, he met with Nasser and other figures inside Nasser's movement. In fact, when you talk with Huber, he's got an extraordinary, almost like a Rolodex, of important figures in the Arab world that he has personally met with, in part because Huber made his living as a journalist and had tremendous access as a Swiss journalist. He could go virtually anywhere. But the way Huber explained it to me is that when he was in Egypt, he began meeting all these old Nazis and supporters of the Nazis, including the Grand Mufti and also Nasser. He told me that Nasser was one of the first people to explain to him how much he Nasser, admired Nazi Germany. Huber told me that Nasser had actually been to the 1936 Olympics. He said that Nasser was very much an athlete, and although he was not a member of the Egyptian Olympic team, he was not a competitor. He was part of the group that went to Germany for the Olympics in 1936 with the Egyptian team. And he said that when he came to Germany, he thought he was in paradise, in an extremely modern society, extremely clean society, et cetera, et cetera. So Nasser had an impression of Hitler and of the Nazis, you know, which was a much more favorable impression that you know, people in the West would have. And this is later reflected in Nasser and the Young Officers Movement support for the Germans during World War II, when the officers, including Sadat and Nasser, wanted Rommel to win. You know, they wanted the Germans to take over Egypt and throw out the British. So Huber, when he came to Egypt, when he's in the process of converting to Islam, he began meeting all these figures who were very pro-Nazi. And one of the figures was the Grand Mufti, who became a good friend of Huber's, and another was von Leers, who Huber was introduced to while he was in Egypt. And Huber told me that the more he had discussions with these people, the more he said he had to, quote, rethink his views of Nazi Germany. And so the way Huber explained it to me is that his conversion to Islam also came with a rethinking of the Nazi Germany, based on his experiences in the Arab world.
Now, Huber has recently come into view in the contemporary press as an associate of an organization variously called Al-Taqwa, then renamed Nada Management. And there have been a number of allegations of the involvement of Al-Taqwa with Al-Qaeda support activities. Tell us about Huber and Al-Taqwa.
Well,
Huber and Al-Taqwa, excuse
yes,
me.
Yes, I should also note that, I wrote an article for Hitlist about Huber and Al-Taqwa, which can be found on the web as well. And just for the comfort of readers or listeners, you can find it at autonomedia.org.
Autonomedia, and what before autonomedia.org?
It's S-L-A-S-H.
Slash, right.
Yeah, it's spelled out. Or you can just do a Google search and just write in, you know, Coogan, Huber, Swiss, and you'll get it that way as well. Because I obviously can't go into the detail on the radio that I did in my article. So some of the names, if there are Arabic names or other names, if one doesn't sort of see them in print, sometimes it's hard to sort of recognize. But that said, I shall intrepidly go ahead and say that Al-Taqwa, which actually translates as Fear of God, was a banking organization set up in the 1980s by a man named Youssef Nada, last name N-A-D-A. And Huber was called upon by Nada and other members of the Al-Taqwa banking network to become basically an advisor, a member of the board of advisors of Al-Taqwa. Technically, Al-Taqwa is not quite a bank. It's more of kind of a financial management corporation. And they needed a Swiss citizen to incorporate in Lugano, where they were set up. What it turns out is that Al-Taqwa came under a great deal of interest by the United States government after September 11th, and in November of 2001, Al-Taqwa was basically put on a list of suspected terrorist organizations that were involved that the United States believed could very well have been involved in financing the Bin Laden organization. This is because Al-Taqwa, it turns out, is a major bank for an organization called the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood is a extremely important group that dates back to the 1920s that has branches all throughout the Arabic world. And the suspicion was that Al-Taqwa and Huber, in particular, may have wanted to help finance the Bin Laden group against the United States.
Huber has a lot of interesting connections, and again, there are numerous broadcasts on which we've discussed Al-Taqwa and the allegations of involvement with the Al-Qaeda milieu, and we'll give the URL for your article from Hitlist magazine. By the way, that article was read into the record, the vast bulk of the article was read into the record in For the Record 354. It's also available on the Internet with a few revisions. We'll give that URL at the end of the discussion, but what are the aspects of Huber's career, I have to train myself to say pronounce that right, that we didn't get too much of a chance to go into in For the Record 354, We did touch on this in For the Record 343. Now, this, again, is an individual who has made the Shahada, the profession of Islamic faith. So he's actually converted to Islam.
Yes. In fact, the first words to me that he said when I met him were, besides saying hello, were, please take off your shoes. This is a Muslim household. Mm-hmm. No, he's a very serious Muslim.
And Von Leers had also converted to Islam and had renamed himself Omar Amin Von Leers.
Yes.
One of the interesting things about Huber, there are a lot of interesting things about Huber and his background, but in addition to his obviously very serious Islamic affiliation, he also maintains some interesting connections with a milieu that centers around the Avalon Gemeinschaft. If you could tell us what that is, what Huber's involvement with that is, and why that represents such a dichotomous relationship. That is to say, Huber and Islam, and then Huber with the Avalon Gemeinschaft.
Yes, yes. The Avalon Gemeinschaft, or the Avalon Society, is a group that had been set up in Switzerland by some far-rightists to promote a policy of promoting pagan, Celtic almost, culture. They were following in the footsteps of the French New Right, which also very much involved sort of sword and sorcery, legends of the ancient Europeans and of King Arthur and Lord of the Rings-style mythology to present sort of an idea of a mystical European man with swords and noble souls fighting against the heathens or fighting against the enemy. So the Avalon Gemeinschaft is a organization that is primarily interested not in monotheism but in paganism and Indo-European paganism, very much copied from the sort of mythology that the SS was very much involved with Odin and Odinism and things like that. So it seems highly peculiar that a devout Muslim like Huber would have anything to do with such a group. But I think the way Huber explained it to me was to say that he had been actually invited by the Avalon Gemeinschaft, which does sponsor lectures, to give a lecture on the nature of Islam, and that once he made the connection, he found himself in a situation where he felt comfortable, and he more and more took on the position of a leading figure in the Avalon Gemeinschaft. And the way Huber explained it to me is that his purpose with groups like the Avalon Gemeinschaft is to try and set up an understanding between the European far right and the Arabic far right. He always makes the point to me, or he made the point to me when we were talking, that he is continually trying to develop connections to overcome dislike between the Europeans and the Arabs, because you have to remember that a lot of far right activity in Europe is actually based around fear of Arabic immigration. And when I was in Switzerland, the best-selling book was actually a polemic against Arabic immigration to Switzerland, arguing that that Switzerland was losing its Swiss character, through the immigration of all these foreigners from the Middle East. So the position that Huber is advocating within the far right is not necessarily at all a popular position to be sympathetic to the Islamic world. But the way Huber explained it to me is that what he tells people in the far right is that the only way that Europe can remain, quote, European or remain, white. And Huber said to me, Europe has to be white. It's not, brown or beige or anything like that. European culture is a white culture. But the way to do that is for the European far right to support Islamic revolutions inside the Arab world to such a degree that the Arabs who are now living in Europe can then go back to the Arab world after their societies have been taken over by the Islamists. So his pitch to the far right, and which he uses the Avalon Gemeinschaft to promote, is the idea that by having the far right ally with radical Arab groups in the Third World, that this is the best way to put a check on immigration from the Third World and from the Arabs in particular to Europe. So it's kind of a very funny relationship that he has, but nonetheless, he's an important figure in that organization.
Another dichotomy in the types of associations that Huber has, if you could tell us about Huber and the Shiites, and in particular his admiration for, and apparently mutual admiration for, Khomeini.
when I asked him about this, I said, "Well, how can you be a Sunni and be so close to Khomeini?"
Mm-hmm.
And the way Cooper put it to me is, he said, "The only way I can explain to you is that I'm a Sunni with the heart of a Shia," meaning that he had the sort of the energy and enthusiasm or fanaticism of a Shia while remaining in the Sunni tradition. But he was extremely close to the Ayatollah Khomeini. In fact, he was one of the closest European followers of Islam to the Ayatollah. And Huber, I believe, or it was reported, I believe it's true, was the only European follower of Islam ever to be allowed to give a speech at the tombstone of the Ayatollah.
You mentioned, too, that Huber has liaised with not only American far-rightists, but also with American African-American Muslims, and in particular people who were associated with some of the pro-Iranian groups within the African-American Muslim community.
Yes, no, that's actually extremely interesting. And in this context, I should add that the New Yorker magazine ran an article, I think about a week ago, on an American pro-Iranian Muslim who was black, who carried out an assassination of a supporter of the Shah of Iran in 1980, and then fled to Iran. His American name is Bleifeld. And in the article, it discusses the fact that Bleifeld had been recruited into the Islamic support network for Khomeini by a man named Saeed Ramadan. And it turns out that Saeed Ramadan was the head of the mosque in Geneva where Huber first converted to Islam. And it later turns out, according to the article, which is based on interviews with Bleifeld, that he actually worked as kind of an agent for Saeed Ramadan in Europe, primarily in the Middle East, during the 1980s. So we have this very curious fact that although the Muslim Brotherhood is primarily a kind of creation of Sunniism, the Muslim Brotherhood, even in the earlier period, was working in the 1970s. Key figures in the Brotherhood were working with these kind of black Islamic radicals in support of the Ayatollah Khomeini.
That's interesting. And the Muslim Brotherhood is primarily Sunni, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely.
And Saeed Ramadan, actually, I believe, took over the organization after Hassan al-Banna.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Who was the founder originally in 1928. That, one of the things that one discovers when you examine the Muslim Brotherhood is they oscillate a lot. They will be at times allied with a particular regime and then opposed to them. They're now at loggerheads with Gaddafi, among others, in the Islamic world.
Well, I asked Huber about this because, as an outsider, I find it very puzzling. You'd think there'd be a very clean split between the Sunni and the Shia.
Mm-hmm.
The way Huber explained it to me is he said, well, some of the older people think that this is very, very important, but it's more now in the Muslim world a relationship the way, especially with the younger people, the way sort of Catholics and Protestants think about each other. I mean, in the 1920s and 30s, if you were an American Catholic or an American Protestant, there'd be a lot of religious tension between between those two groups. I mean, the Protestants would say the Pope is trying to take over the United States, or the Catholics would say the Protestants are discriminating against us, etc. But by the time the 1960s happened, the Catholic-Protestant antagonism in the United States basically died out. And I think something similar is going on inside the Islamic world. At least that's the way Huber explained it to me.
Kevin, we're coming down to the end of this interview. One of Huber's liaisons was with, going back to some of his liaising with American far-rightists and also African-American Muslims, was some people who maintain connections with an organization called the New Black Panthers.
Yes, that's correct. And in my article, I identify two black Muslim, although they're not black Muslim in the sense of they're Farrakhan supporters.
Right.
They're actually black people who converted to a Khomeini version of Islam, who were friends with Huber, who later appeared at a conference of the New Black Panther Party, which I cite in my article. The thing to remember about Huber, one of the fascinating things, is that for over a decade, Huber has traveled extensively in the United States. And Huber has made many, many contacts, not just in the right-wing community, but primarily in the Muslim community, because he was sponsored by a group, basically a Muslim student organization, to address Muslims all across the country. So, I mean, Huber's been to New York, Washington, Salt Lake City, San Francisco, etc. Huber told me, however, that based on the advice of his lawyers, that he will no longer travel to either the United States or England for fear of arrest. But as I say, for a decade, Hooper's been making these very significant contacts, much like Saeed Ramadan did in Washington in the 1970s.
Hooper is also associated with the NPD, which is arguably the top German neo-Nazi party. And in that regard, he is an associate of, or fellow traveler of, a fellow named Horst Mahler, who also embraces some of these seemingly dichotomous political relationships. Bearing in mind that we're near the end of the interview,
sure.
I wonder if you could tell us briefly about Horst Mahler, also an individual that you were able to speak with recently in Europe.
Yes, I actually met Horst Mahler. He lives in a suburb of Berlin called Kleinmachnow. Very briefly, Horst Mahler was a former leading figure of the Red Army Fraction, which was an ultra-leftist group better known as the Bader-Meinhof Gang. He was arrested in the early 70s, spent some time in prison, basically renounced the Red Army tactic, and when he left prison was involved with the Maoist organization for a few years. He then became a... Horst Mahler had been trained as a lawyer, and then in the late 1980s, he legally petitioned to become a lawyer again. He had lost his right to practice. But by the 1990s, Mahler became increasingly visible in the far-right scene, and he primarily right now is associated with a group called the Deutsche College, which is his own organization, and also with the NPD, as a representative of the NPD. He and Hooper link up through the Holocaust denial movement primarily, and Hooper has also given speeches at NPD gatherings in Germany, which have been backed by Mahler as well.
Mahler also, when he was in his incarnation with the Bader-Meinhof, not only touched bases with various pro-Arab, anti-Israeli activists, but also had at least some contact with the milieu of Jenu, did he not?
Well, it's hard to say, to tell you the truth, because Mahler was arrested pretty early in. Mahler was basically snitched out, I think around like 1970 or 71. But before that, and this is one of the mysteries, to tell you the truth, about Horst Mahler, he spent time in camps, in Palestinian camps in Lebanon, where he got guerrilla training. Now, actually, what the people I spoke to in Germany about this period, many of the people that I spoke to felt that they believed that Mahler may actually received financing from the Stasi, from the East German Secret Service, during this period, because the Stasi itself was giving support to groups like the PFLP. And Wadi Hadad in particular. So Mahler's earlier period is actually pretty murky. And I just don't know. No one really knows whether the Horst Mahler of today is operating with the same kind of mindset as the Horst Mahler of 20 or 30 years ago. One thing I can say is that the Horst Mahler that I spoke to was very much involved in. He had a very mystical, weird, religious idea of the German Volk. And it's not the kind of mentality one would associate with a traditional classic Marxist, which Mahler clearly was in the late 1970s. So I would just put a question mark over that period of Mahler's life.
Last point, Kevin, because we're almost out of
sure.
time. But Mahler was quite visible in the days after September 11th with at least a qualified endorsement of the events of September 11th.
Oh, yes. I asked Mahler about that, and Mahler said that he wanted to be very upfront about that to make it clear that he supported any and all actions against the United States.
All righty. If you could give us briefly, Kevin, the URL for your article about Ahmed Hooper.
Well, briefly, I think all that one would need to do would be to go to http://flash.com/ Autonomedia, autonomedia.org. And when you get to that web page, just do the search, just type in Kevin Coogan, last name Coogan, and you'll find the article on Hooper. Or you can just go to Google and just type in Ahmed, A-C-H-M-E-D, Hooper, H-U-B-E-R, and Kevin Coogan, and you should find it as well.
And also, Kevin Coogan is, of course, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yaki and the Postwar Fascist International, an encyclopedic work and one of the best books ever written about fascism, published in soft cover by Autono Media, published in 1999 and edited by on-air personality Dave Mandel. of sister station WFMU. Kevin, thanks for visiting with us.
Yes, okay, thank you very much.
And that concludes, for the record, number 371, side 2. This is being recorded on August 5th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.